John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my rock?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, December 29, 2011. Israeli authorities to open Kerem Abu Salem crossing to allow food supplies and other materials into the besieged Gaza Strip. An Israeli Navy attacked Gaza fishermen and international observers in Gaza waters. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli authorities said it will open the Kerem Abu Salem crossing to allow some basic material to enter into the besieged Gaza Strip, Palestinian media sources reported Thursday. A total of 260 trucks will contain mainly food supplies and some agricultural material and equipment, in addition to 59 truckloads of construction material to be specially used by the United Nations Work and Relief Agency of the Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, for its reconstruction projects. The sources added that a few thousand liters of cooking gas will be pumped into the besieged coastal region as well. In addition, one truckload of chili pepper will be allowed out of the Gaza Strip. On Wednesday, Israeli authorities allowed the export of one truckload of chili pepper and allowed the entry of some aid packages, food supplies, and some construction materials. The siege on Gaza has been imposed since 2006 and tightened in 2007. Over 300 Palestinians from the Gaza Strip died for lack of medical supplies and inability to travel to Egypt for medical treatment. Israeli security forces arrested prominent right-wing Jewish activists in a West Bank settlement early Thursday over suspicions of monitoring the movements of Israeli soldiers in the region, the Israeli newspaper Haaretz said. Haaretz added that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu approved a series of steps to crack down on Jewish extremists responsible for recent violent attacks on Israeli soldiers. Because of lack of material evidence against the settlers, Netanyahu approved issuing an administrative detention order against them. However, he rejected a recommendation to label them as, quote, terror group, end quote. Settler assaults against Israeli military and assaults against Palestinian civilians have been increasing in various West Bank regions, with mosques as primary targets. In other news, Israeli sources reported that Israeli warplanes shelled two locations for Palestinian fighters in the Gaza Strip as a response to Palestinian projectiles fired into Israel earlier in the day. The airstrike targeted a tunnel used by Palestinian fighters north of the Gaza Strip as a training compound. On Wednesday night, an Israeli naval warship attacked the international observers and Palestinian captain of the Civil Peace Service Gaza boat, Olivia, injuring its captain in an apparent attempt to capsize it. The international observers said they had trouble with their engine and could not move their boat, and the Israeli Navy continued going around them in circles. When the warship was 2 meters away from the Olivia, one of the waves it had created nearly capsized the small boat, filling it with water and causing the Palestinian captain to fall out, injuring his left leg. That was all for today from the IMEMC News. This was Thursday, December 29th, daily roundup of news from the occupied Palestinian territories. We hope you will join us again tomorrow. This was brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, George Rishmal.
From a small office on a busy street in Tel Aviv, Israel, a trio of women produced the influential website Who Profits? It's a project of the Women's Coalition for Peace that investigates companies that profit from the Israeli occupation of the West Bank, part of the Palestinian occupied territories. They research global companies involved in construction, communication, and in some cases, exploitation of Palestinian resources for export. Rona Moran, one of the Israeli women researchers, explains that the project was born out of a heated debate about whether the Women's Coalition should support the call by many Palestinian civil society groups for boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel, known as BDS. Researching the companies that profit was a compromised position, a way of collecting more information, but it has also become an invaluable tool for solidarity activists all over the world. In exposing companies and corporations involved in the occupation, the group hopes to promote a change in public opinion and corporate policies, leading to an end to the occupation. The fact that one of the researchers is a Palestinian-Israeli citizen means she can visit parts of the West Bank for her research that the other two women are barred from. On a recent visit to Israel on the West Bank, Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Rona Moran, who talks about the effectiveness of their project in exposing companies that profit from the Israeli occupation of Palestinian land.
What we are doing, we are an information center and for calls and for questions from all over the world of activists that are asking, what is the situation? Is this company involved in activity in the West Bank? And we can say, this is the situation right now. They withdrew from, they closed their factory, they invested in this company. And the fact that we are able to read in Hebrew and to check and monitor the activities of these companies allow us to spread this information for a very vast community of activists all over the world. Our function in this system is to provide the most accurate and updated information that we can find.
Can you tell me about any particular information that you found through your research that turned out to be really useful for folks who are interested in this issue?
For example, last week we had some French activists over here and they asked about French companies, and then I told them about the involvement of Veolia in the occupied territories. It's a huge French company that is involved in infrastructure projects, usually working on the transportation, water, and garbage disposal, things like that. And they are heavily involved in the building and operating of the light rail train in Jerusalem, which is a massive project that was built in order to connect the settlement in the east side of Jerusalem into the west side of the city. So they practically built it, and there was a very intense international campaign against it. But during the research, at the beginning, we only knew about the light rail, but as we checked all the subsidiaries of the company, we discovered that they have a landfill in the Jordan Valley, and that they transfer and they waste from inside Israel into the occupied territories to that landfill. And we discovered that they operate through their transportation unit and a subsidiary called Connex a few bus lines that go on apartheid roads from Modi'in Elit to Jerusalem and Beit Horon area, and Palestinians are not allowed to use this road. So the deeper you go, the more things come up. For example, the information about the landfill was received from a request for information that we filed for the civil administrations and Ministry of Security. And so we received the information, and 2 days later it was, you know, spread to... So it's important to us that we will be able to provide information, you know, on real time sometimes. Usually we work with the information that companies publish themselves on their websites, on marketing materials, in reports that they file for the state or for financial issues. Their annual reports is one of the best information sources there are. Sometimes you get all the information and you get it fast. Sometimes security issues do come up, and then we have to apply to the Supreme Court in several occasions.
We just spoke to someone who works, you know, on the BDS campaign, and he says it's been very successful. You know, in the 6 years since it started, it's really kind of taken off, and there is some awareness around the world about it. But how do you view it? Do you think that it is a successful campaign, and if so, how do you judge that?
I can say it only as a fellow activist and not as a part of the project. I think that the economic pressure is heavily felt by Israeli companies and by the Israeli government, who fear this campaign greatly. And you can see it in hysterical reactions of diplomatic Israeli representatives all over the world when they have to address the issue of the boycott. I think we are only getting started. This is only the beginning. The more information that we'll have on this issue and the more successful campaigns that we will have, I believe that international companies will find it a lot more complicated to be involved in this kind of activity. I think that the most important thing that we can say about the project is that it reveals something that people usually don't understand. When you speak about economic activity in the occupied territories, people think about settlement products. Settlement products are almost insignificant. They are such a small portion of the economic activity that is going on in the West Bank that dealing with it is like, it's like peanuts. The involvement of Israeli companies in the Israeli economic system in the West Bank is massive. It's undeniable, and it involves banks and construction companies and law firms, and every part of the Israeli market is there. The fact that Israeli companies use the Palestinian market as a captive market, it's such an enormous advantage for them. So in many ways, we want to show the wider picture. And to show that the involvement doesn't stop at the green line. You don't have to have a factory in a settlement in order to be involved over there. So this is the main thing.
That was Rona Moran of the research project Who Profits. To find a link to the group's website and additional information, visit our website at btlonline.org.
Afghanistan today. Another man in an Afghan army uniform suddenly opened fire and killed 2 more NATO soldiers of unspecified nationality. This has been happening since Afghanistan was at war with the Soviets. Afghanistan today. A roadside bomb killed at least 10 police officers in Helmand province, according to police. The Taliban took responsibility for the explosion. Pakistan ongoing. An insurgent assassin squad called Khorasan Mojahideen is hunting down and executing the rats and snitches that feed targeting information to the U.S. drone assassination program. They answer assassination with assassination, sealing off whole villages while suspects are interrogated in front of everyone in a time-honored counterintelligence practice going back at least to the Viet Cong. While Pakistani elders and tribal officials claim most of the people executed as informants are innocent, for them not to claim this would imply that they knowingly sheltered informants and they would be next. It is impossible to verify claims of innocence or guilt in these cases unless the execution of an informer causes a chain of drone bombings to stop. Nonetheless, the LA Times story recounting this includes a statement by a man the militants arrested who maintained his innocence and was released. The original reason he had been captured was that two suspects were seen hanging around his shop. I wouldn't bet on Homeland Security, the FBI, or even the DC police behaving any better. Iraq, yesterday, four mortar shells hit Camp Ashraf, home of the exiled Iranian dissident group MEK that was once protected by the former Iraqi government. Fortunately, there were no reports of injuries. This is in spite of an agreement being reached to resettle Camp Ashraf residents outside Iraq. Iraq, yesterday, four roadside bombs and one magnetic bomb attached to a car detonated around the country, killing one Iraqi government soldier and wounding 14 people, five of them police and one of them another government soldier. Mr. Barack Obama, Iraq is no model for Afghanistan. 8 years of U.S. war, some of it under your command, could not stabilize the country, and the war that began with the U.S. invasion continues much as it did when U.S. troops were present. Now is the time to pull the plug and get all the way out of the entire Middle East. Bring home the rest of the troops, bring home the contractors, shut down those overgrown U.S. embassies, and remove U.S. corporate influence from the whole Middle East.
After 18 months in custody, Army Private First Class Bradley Manning made his first public appearance just before Christmas at what's known as an Article 32 pretrial hearing at Fort Meade, Maryland. The hearing is the required next step in the military's legal process before the expected court-martial of the 24-year-old Manning that will likely begin in 6 to 9 months. Private Manning stands accused by the U.S. government of being the source of 260,000 diplomatic government cables and more than 90,000 intelligence reports later distributed to the press by WikiLeaks. Manning, who has been held in solitary confinement under conditions that his attorney and supporters characterize as cruel and degrading, faces 22 charges, including aiding the enemy, which carry a possible 30 years in jail. Manning's lawyer, David Coombs, has based his defense strategy on two main points. One, the leaks did little real damage to U.S. national security. And two, the military's lax security in running Manning's intelligence unit and their failure to notice and take action to address behavior indicating Private Manning was suffering from psychological distress. Your reporter spoke with Rainey Reitman, a steering committee member of the Bradley Manning Support Network. She summarizes what took place at Manning's pretrial hearing and concerns about how the hearing was conducted and the direction of the prosecution's case.
The way the hearing sort of unfolded, the government, the prosecution, was basing its argument line basically around forensic analysis. They collected all these different computers that Bradley Manning had used at different times and then did forensic analysis on them to try and pinpoint data that indicated Manning had accessed documents that later came up on the WikiLeaks website. And the defense took a different tactic. The defense said, we are here not just to discuss what happened or how it happened, but to discuss why it happened and to talk about this larger issue of government transparency. One of the major focal points of the defense's argument is that there have been no negative repercussions to this information being published, and that what is being charged against Bradley Manning is an enormous overreaction, that he should not be facing 150 years in prison, 24-year-old guy, just trying to make this country a better place, for something that, in effect, did not have any negative impact on our soldiers overseas or on our negotiations in world spheres. So that was one of their core arguments. I believe many of the witnesses that were denied were going to speak to that particular issue.
What kind of penalty do the charges that Bradley Manning faces, what is his possible jail sentence if he is convicted for these crimes? And I know the defense is concerned that the harshness of the sentence that he may be liable to get is in part a way to pressure him to cooperate with the prosecution to pursue a prosecution against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. You want to speak to that, please?
Yes, I think you nailed it on the head. The defense and many of the analysts who've been watching this case believe that the government is pursuing Bradley Manning in this particularly harsh manner because they are hoping to get him to testify against WikiLeaks and Julian Assange and also to make an example of him. The the charges altogether, if Manning were to be convicted of all of them and get the highest sentence, would be some 150 years in prison. The death penalty is actually still on the table. The prosecution has stated that they aren't, at this point anyway, going to pursue the death penalty, though it's certainly possible that that's something that could be faced. The defense has asked that most of these charges be dropped, especially egregious ones like aiding the enemy, and that instead they face simple overstepping classification boundaries and something more to the tune of, maximum charge, 30 years. And so what we're waiting for now is for the investigating officer to review the information that was reported to him and decide if he's going to recommend that all of those charges go to a court-martial or whether they should be reduced before the court-martial.
Rainey, I wanted to discuss with you the allegation by the defense that there is an epidemic of overclassified U.S. government documents that in some way led somebody like Bradley Manning to release them, thinking that the public has a right to know many of the things that were divulged in the documents that WikiLeaks eventually did release to the public and the press. Tell us a bit about overclassification as an issue here.
Well, this has actually become a huge issue of public controversy. As you probably know, in 2010 alone, there were 77 million documents classified by our government. That's a 40% jump over the prior year. And the number of people with security clearances is around 4.2 million. That's more people than there are in the city of Los Angeles. The classification of documents has become the default in our military culture. There's this idea to constantly hide things away, but many of the things that are being so carefully classified are not only things that won't hurt or endanger our military work overseas, they also are attempts to cover up some very concerning situations that happen. So, for example, one of the leaks that has not come out yet, has yet to be published, but is attributed to Bradley Manning, is the Guarani airstrike, also known as the Granai massacre, in which there's an airstrike by U.S. military forces that killed, I think it was a total of about 120 people. I'm not sure on the total, but it was 90 school children. And this is along with the video collateral murder, which shows two Reuters journalists getting gunned down by Americans. Some of the things that Manning saw that led him to speak out and to leak documents. So there's this idea that there was no method, no mechanism in place whatsoever that someone like Bradley Manning would have had a way to get that information out other than leaking it, because there's no way to really unclassify documents for somebody like Bradley Manning, who saw something that disturbed his conscience.
That was Rainey Reitman, a steering committee member of the Bradley Manning Support Network. Learn more about the issues in the Bradley Manning case by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Iowa, the 28th of December. Occupy has started their campaign against Republicans at the Iowa caucuses. On the 28th of December, Occupy protesters interrupted one of racist Ron Paul's campaign speeches.
Freedom of speech! Ain't it wonderful?
Yeah.
Obviously, Iowa occupiers are not impressed with Ron Paul's support for corporate free trade and discrimination against immigrants. While all the lobbyists on K Street have been eating like pigs the past few weeks, Adrian Parsons at Occupy DC is now on day 22 of his hunger strike, demanding voting rights and budget autonomy for DC. This one's for you, Adrian.
I don't mind stealing bread from the mouths of decadence, but I can't beat all the powerless when my cup's already
Talk. I am known as the homeless advocate, and today I am doing my first state of homelessness address. And I should begin by saying that I've been advocating for Washington, D.C.'s homeless community for about 5.5 years now. I began advocating in June of 2006, and before I talk about the events of the past year, let me give you a very quick update on how things have gone ever since I began advocating for the homeless. We started with the Franklin School Shelter when Anthony Williams, the former mayor of Washington, D.C., threatened to close the shelter, and we actually won against him and stopped the closure, and then a man named Adrian Fenty became mayor in January 2007, and even though he had promised during his campaign to keep Franklin School open as a shelter, he ended up closing it in September of 2008. Well, as it turns out, Washington, D.C. counts its homeless people every January, and in January of 2008, we counted 6,044 homeless people. 8 months later, when Franklin School Shelter was closed, Mayor Fenty actually began the Permanent Supportive Housing Program. That program has now housed approximately 1,500 homeless people. But in spite of that, in 2011, in January, we counted 6,546 homeless people. So, even though the homeless are being housed, we still have more than 500 additional homeless people. And what that brings to mind is the fact that we're always behind the ball. You know, in spite of the programs that are being created, we can't seem to house people more quickly than they become homeless. And that is a lingering problem in terms of ending homelessness on the local level, as well as on the federal level. And I've been telling many people about this issue and really admonishing them to figure out a new way of trying to end homelessness. How can we get in front of the ball? And the simple answer would be that we need to figure out how people are becoming homeless, and we need to capture them before they enter shelter. There's a certain analogy that I give people where I say, if your water supply line is leaking in your house, you don't mop the floor first, you stop the leak. You go turn off the water. If the water is still running and it's still flowing all over the floor, there's no point in mopping, right? And so you stop the flow into homelessness, and then you clean up what you already have. Now, many folk have made the point to me, and I agree, that it's not either or, it's both and. But as it turns out, on both the federal level and the local level here in Washington, D.C., we have people who are trying to get those who are homeless out of homelessness, but they're not stopping folks from flowing in. And so we have to do both. So now we have Vincent Gray as mayor. Now Vincent Gray actually has a history of working in human services. In the 90s, he was the director of DC government's Department of Human Services. And we thought that his history working in human services would factor into what he did for the homeless while mayor. But unfortunately, it hasn't. And so, according to DC law, on April 1st, 2011, Vincent Gray issued his budget proposal. And in that budget proposal, it said that there was a $20.5 million budget shortfall for homeless services. Now, that doesn't mean money was taken out. What that means is that in this year, it would cost more to do the same things that we did last year. And it also means that some federal money was taken away. And so that ended up with us having a $20.5 million budget shortfall as DC government had to fill the gap for what federal monies were no longer receiving. And so the government threatened to close all DC city-run shelters on April 1st of 2012. The advocates came out in force. There was a day that we had about 250 advocates in City Hall, in the John A. Wilson building, pressuring the council to find money to fill the gap for homeless services and to keep the shelters open beyond April 1st of 2012. And they found $17 million. They took it from the Housing Production Trust Fund and they put it into homeless services. Well, as it turns out, I was at a COHO meeting on April 14th before the money was found. And COHO stands for Coalition of Housing and Homeless Organizations. They meet on the second Thursday of every month. And while there, we were talking about the impending crisis and how that the shelters were threatened to be shut down on April 1st of 2012. And a man named John said, "Who's going to tell the poor and the homeless about these cuts that are going to directly affect them?" And John, myself, and several other people met after that meeting, and we made arrangements to meet in the basement of the CCNV homeless shelter, that is the Community for Creative Nonviolence, where I presently reside. And the director, Rico Harris, was very gracious and offered us that space, and we began to meet every Monday from 1 to 3 in the drop-in. And we've been meeting now for about 8 months. But nonetheless, going back to the budget fight, the city did find $17 million, and the shelters are going to be saved and kept open year-round, because the way DC law reads, they only have to shelter the homeless for the 5 coldest months of the year, from November 1st, or the first freezing night, if it comes before November 1st, until April, or until March 31st, or the last freezing night. And beyond that, they have no obligation to shelter anybody. They've been offering year-round shelter, but they were saying that because of the budget, they were going to scale back and do just the bare minimum of offering shelter 5 months out of the year. But we came out and we fought that fight and we won it and we got $17 million put back in. But at any rate, we had to deal with the federal government as well. And the federal government was talking about cutting $5.7 billion, with a B, from HUD housing. That is Housing and Urban Development. And that department creates Section 8 housing for poor people across the country. Here in Washington, D.C., we have over 11,000 HUD housing vouchers citywide. And there was a threat to cut 5,000, or almost half, of the citywide HUD housing vouchers. Well, as it turns out, Congress has scaled back the cuts, and now they're only talking about cutting $1.4 billion. And so rather than losing 5,000 vouchers here in D.C., we might only lose 1,250, which is still a loss, but it's not as big a loss as what they had threatened originally. And so we can take that as a gain and as a win. But as it turns out, what happens on Capitol Hill trickles down to D.C. government as well. And so if the HUD housing is cut at all, those people, if they can't find some other way to maintain their own housing to pay their own rent, they'll become homeless, and that will add to the number of homeless people that D.C. has. And because the law requires that they shelter all people who need it during the five coldest months of the year, if these cuts occur during the winter, then the city will have to scramble to get these people housed or sheltered, and that will cut into the $17 million that we got put back into homeless services. And so if this cut occurs on the federal level, we might be back at square one on April 1st. Let's hope not. But here in D.C., as it turns out, all over the country actually, the fastest growing segment of the homeless population is families. From January of 2008 to January 2009, the number of homeless families grew by 25% in the D.C. metro area. And this is getting to be a really big problem. You see, when individuals become homeless, folk tend to blame that individual for their own missteps, whether it was drug addiction or alcoholism or not paying the rent or some other personal vice. But when families become homeless, people tend to blame the economy. They're more sympathetic to families that become homeless, but that sympathy doesn't house people. And in closing, I want to address the issue of moving the homeless from homelessness to self-sufficiency. Well, you know, I do have to give the city credit for housing some of the homeless. Like I said earlier, the program that was begun during the Clinton administration has housed about 1,500 homeless people at this point, but it still falls woefully short of ending the problem of homelessness. And so we still have more homeless people than we had before that program was begun. And during his administration, there were people who talked about how we're warehousing the homeless, and that is very much the truth, that we are warehousing the homeless. In the past, there have been programs that were geared toward getting people out of homelessness, and while I can't speak to their success or lack thereof, I do know that when you look at the raw numbers of homeless people as we count them every January, that number just keeps going up. And so during a budget crunch, during an economic downturn, when funding is cut, what they cut is the funding for programs that would move people out of homelessness, and they retain the funding for shelter. And so what we end up with is just bare-bone shelter that does nothing but warehouse the homeless, and that has been a major problem when it comes to dealing with the homeless issue. Well, as it turns out, myself and others have done some peer-to-peer mentoring. I myself have actually gone out to the D.C. General Hospital, which is now being used as a shelter because the hospital was closed 10 years ago. And I've gone to the family shelter on the D.C. General grounds, and I've actually done some tutoring of the women there. And we're really working to help them get their GED and to get jobs and to become self-sufficient, and hoping to get some sort of funding for what we do so that we can continue to do this work and do it in a more robust manner. As it turns out, here in Washington, D.C., the government likes for you to go out without their money first and to do what you do and get results, and then if they like the results you get, then they may fund you on the back end. And at Streets and Sharp, we've really been doing this work for a while, and hopefully that the city will begin to recognize what we do and to give us funding so that we can do it better and in a bigger and better way. And so all we can do is hope, and as we move into this new year, into 2012, we'll see what the future holds.
Twitter has just gotten caught suspending or deleting accounts of users who talk too much about Occupy Wall Street. One user, David Seaman at the Business Insider, reported that his account was suspended for annoying our users after just two tweets about Occupy Wall Street that must have been followed by the wrong people. This is in spite of the fact that those who do not like Occupy Wall Street could have simply unfollowed him. Doing a little digging, he found three more users who had been removed from Twitter for the same so-called offense. Hey Twitter, this is some change from standing down a service upgrade that would have disrupted service during the revolt in Iran. What does Occupy Wall Street need to do to avoid random account suspensions? Move to Iran? Seriously, folks, this is why I've been telling you for years to never trust corporate social media like Facebook and obviously Twitter as well. Any cloud service owned by a corporation and supporting itself by advertisements has a vested interest in censoring and snitching on any kind of activism that threatens corporate profits. Still wonder why we need things like pirate radio and independent media centers that don't support themselves by advertising? On the 25th of December, Christmas Day in the Southern Ocean, the whales got their gift from Sea Shepherd. An unmanned drone aircraft, the Nicole Montecalvo, found the whalers and their factory ship, the Nishan Maru, while they were still 1,000 miles away from the whale sanctuary. The two security ships tailing to Steve Irwin have turned out once again to be ordinary harpoon ships, not Japanese warships. As a result, the illegal whalers, poachers according to international law, are going to have a very, very hard time this year. Last year, it took a manned helicopter 18 hours of flight time to locate the factory ship, and the whalers escaped when the pilot was forced to land for a nap. That cost a few hundred whales their lives. Sea Shepherd managed to catch the whalers again, even sending them home a month early, but the hope was to keep them from killing a single whale. This year, Sea Shepherd has multiple drones, and drones don't have to sleep. The drones can alternate flight coverage 24/7, one after the other, indefinitely. They fly too high for the whalers to shoot down, yet close enough to easily photograph and vector in the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society's three ships for direct action. Security ships can radio the positions of Sea Shepherd ships all they want. It won't let any of the poaching ships escape, not with a drone glued solidly to the Nishan Maru's wake at all times. Meanwhile, citizen groups in Japan are outraged that some of the international donations earmarked for relief and recovery after last spring's devastating earthquake and tsunami have been diverted to the whalers. That money is needed for things like cleaning up the terrible radioactive mess TEPCO's nuclear reactors brought back to Japan, not to subsidize poachers who bring the whole country nothing but shame and empty cargo holds. Will this be the year the whales can truly celebrate VSO Day for victory in the Southern Ocean?